sense of his own value, too much affected by that Scotch love of a grievance. And there was that unfortunate title hanging about his neck, a beloved millstone. There was something of Cochrane in Jack, a restless impatience of authority, a strong persuasion of being in the right. But not enough to disqualify him, not nearly enough. And in any case, it had been diminishing fast these last years. What were the constants? A cheerful resilience, a competent readiness, an open conversability, a certain candour. How much of this was the sea, the common stimuli? How much was the profession, the choice of those who shared a particular cast of mind? "The captain's under way," whispered his neighbour, touching his shoulder and bending to speak in his ear. "Why, so he is," said Stephen, getting to his feet. "He has catted his fish." They slowly climbed the companion ladder. The heat on deck was even greater than below now that the breeze had died away entirely. On the larboard side a sail had been lowered into the water, buoyed at its extremities, and weighted in the middle to form a swimming bath. And half the ship's company were splashing about in it. To starboard, perhaps 2 miles away, lay the rocks, no longer anything like ships at all, but still dazzling white from the edge of the deep blue sea to their tops, some 50 feet above the surface in the case of the biggest, so white that the slow surf showed creamy in comparison. A cloud of gannets sailed overhead, with a mingling of dark, smaller terns. Every now and then, a gannet dived straight down into the sea with a splash like a 4-pounder ball. "Mr. Babington, pray lend me your spyglass," cried Stephen. And when he gazed for a while, "Oh, how I wish I were there. Jack, that is to say, Captain Aubrey, may I have a boat?" "My dear doctor," said Jack, "I'm sure you wouldn't have asked if you had remembered it was Sunday afternoon." Sunday afternoon was holy. It was the men's only holiday, wind, weather, and the malice of the enemy permitting, and they prepared for it with enormous labour on Saturday and on Sunday morning. "Now I must go below and see to that infernal sail-room," he said, turning quickly away from his friend's disappointment. "You'll not forget that we're to call upon Mr. Stanhope before quarters."
"I'll pull you across if you choose," said Nichols a moment later. "I'm sure Harvey'll let us have the jolly boat."
"How very good-natured of you," cried Stephen, looking into Nichols' face.
"Somewhat vinous, but perfectly in command of himself.
I should be infinitely obliged. Give me leave to fetch a hammer, some small boxes, a hat, and I'm with you."
They crawled along the barge, the launch, and one of the cutters to the jolly boat, and they were all towing behind to prevent them opening in the heat, and rowed away. The cheerful noise faded behind them, their wake lengthened across the glassy sea. Stephen took off his clothes and sat naked in his sennit hat. He revelled in the heat, and this had been his daily practice since the latitude of Madeira. At present he was a disagreeable mottled dun colour from head to foot, the initial brown having darkened to a suffused grey. He wasn't much given to washing. Fresh water was not to be had in any event, and the salt from his swimming lay upon him like dust.
"I was contemplating upon sea officers just now," he observed, "and trying to name the qualities that make one cry, 'That man is a sailor,' in the meliorative sense. From that I went on to reflect that the typical sea officer is as rare as your anatomically typical corpse,
That is to say, he is surrounded by what, for want of a better word, I may call unsatisfactory specimens or subspecies. And I was carried on to the reflection that whereas there are many good, or at least amiable, midshipmen, there are fewer good lieutenants, still fewer good captains, and almost no good admirals. A possible explanation may be this. In addition to professional competence, cheerful resignation, an excellent liver, natural authority, and 100 other virtues, there must be the far rarer quality of resisting the effects, the dehumanizing effects, of the exercise of authority. Authority is a solvent of humanity. Look at any husband, any father of a family, and note the absorption of the person by the persona, the individual by the role. Then multiply the family and the authority by some hundreds, and see the effect upon a sea captain, to say nothing of an absolute monarch. Surely man in general is born to be oppressed or solitary, if he is to be fully human, unless it so happens that he is immune to the poison. In the nature of the service, this immunity cannot be detected until late, but it certainly exists. How otherwise are we to account for the rare, but fully human and therefore efficient, admirals we see, such as Duncan, Nelson? He saw that Nichols' attention had wandered, and he let his voice die away to a murmur with no apparent end, took a book from his coat pocket, and, since the nearer sky was empty of birds, fell to reading in it. The oars squeaked against the folds, the blades dipped with a steady beat, and the sun beat down. The boat crept across the sea. From time to time, Stephen looked up, repeating his Urdu phrases, and considering Nichols' face. The man was in a bad way, and had been for some time. Bad at Gibraltar, bad at Madeira, worse since San Diego. Scurvy was out of the question in this case. Syphilis? Worms? "I beg your pardon," said Nichols with an artificial smile. "I'm afraid I'd lost the thread. What were you saying?"
"I was repeating phrases from this little book. It's all I could get apart from the Fort William grammar, which is in my cabin. It is a phrase book, and I believe it must have been compiled by a disappointed man. My horse has been eaten by a tiger, leopard, bear. I wish to hire a palanquin. There are no palanquins in this town, sir. All my money has been stolen. I wish to speak to the collector. The collector is dead, sir. I have been beaten by evil men."
"Yet salacious too, poor burning soul. Woman, wilt thou lie with me?" With an effort at civil interest, Nichols said, "Is that the language you speak with Ahmed?"
"Yes, indeed, all our Lascars speak it. Although they come from widely different parts of India, it is their lingua franca. I chose Ahmed because it is his mother tongue, and he is an obliging, patient fellow. But he cannot read or write, and that is why I ply my grammar, in the hope of fixing the colloquial. Do you not find that a spoken language wafts in and out of your mind, leaving little trace unless you anchor it with print?"
"I can't say I do. I'm no hand at talking foreign. Never was. It quite astonishes me to hear you rattling away with those black men. Even in English, when it comes to anything more delicate than making sail, I find it—" He paused, looking over his shoulder, and said there was no landing this side. It was too steep too, but they might do better on the other. The number of birds had been increasing as they neared the rock. And now, as they pulled round to its southern side, the terns and boobies were thick overhead, flying in and out from their fishing grounds in a bewildering intricacy of crossing paths, the birds all strangely mute. Stephen gazed up into them, equally silent, lost in admiration, until the boat grounded on weed-muffled rock and tilted as Nichols ran it up into a sheltered inlet, heaved it clear of the swell, and handed Stephen out. "Thank you, thank you," said Stephen, scrambling up the dark sea-washed band to the shining white surface beyond. And there he stopped dead. Immediately in front of his nose, almost touching it, there was a sitting booby. 2, 4, 6 boobies, as white as the bare rock they sat on. A carpet of boobies, young and old, and among them quantities of terns. The nearest booby looked at him without much interest. A slight degree of irritation was all he could detect in that long reptilian face and bright round eye. He advanced his finger and touched the bird, which shrugged its person. And as he did so, a great rush of wings filled the air, another booby landing with a full crop for its huge, gaping child on the naked rock a few feet away. "Jesus, Mary and Joseph," he murmured, straightening to survey the island, a smooth mound like a vast worn molar tooth, with birds thick in all the hollows. The hot air was full of their sound, coming and going, full of the ammoniac smell of their droppings and the reek of fish. And all over the hard white surface it shimmered in the heat and the intolerable glare, so the birds 50 yards up the slope could hardly be focused, and the ridge of the mound wavered like a taut rope that had been plucked, waterless, totally arid. Not a blade of grass, not a weed, not a lichen. Stench, blazing rock, and unmoving air. "This is a paradise," cried Stephen. "I'm glad you like it," said Nichols, sitting wearily down on the only clean spot he could find. "You don't find it rather strong for paradise and hellfire hot? The rock's burning through my shoes." "There is an odour, sure," said Stephen, "but by paradise I mean the tameness of the fowl, and I do not believe it is they that smell." He ducked as a tern shot past his head, banking and breaking hard to land. "The tameness of the birds before the fall. I believe this bird will suffer me to smell it. I believe that much, if not all, the odour is that of excrement, dead fish and weed." He moved a little closer to the booby, one of the few still sitting on an egg, knelt by it, gently took its wicked beak and put his nose to its back. "They contribute a good deal, however," he said. The booby looked indignant, ruffled, impenetrably stupid. It uttered a low hiss, but it didn't move away, merely shuffled the egg beneath it, and stared at a crab that was laboriously stealing a flying fish left by a tern at the edge of a nest 2 feet away. From the top of the island he could see the frigate, lying motionless 2 miles off, her sails slack and dispirited. He had left Nichols under a shelter made from their clothes spread on the oars, the only patch of shade on this whole marvellous rock. He had collected 2 boobies and 2 terns. He had had to overcome an extreme reluctance to knock them on the head, but one of the boobies, the red-legged booby, was almost certainly of an undescribed species.
He had chosen birds that were not breeding, and by his estimate of this rock alone there were some 35,000 left. He had filled his boxes with several specimens of a feather-eating moth, a beetle of an unknown genus, two woodlice, apparently identical with those from an Irish turf stack, the agile thievish crab, and a large number of ticks and wingless flies that he would classify in time. Such a haul! Now he was beating the rock with his hammer. Not for geological specimens, for they were already piled in the boat, but to widen a crevice in which an unidentified arachnid had taken refuge. The rock was hard, the crevice deep, the arachnid stubborn. From time to time he paused to breathe the somewhat purer air up here and to look out towards the ship. Eastwards there were far fewer birds, though here and there a gannet cruised or dived with closed wings, plummeting into the sea. When he dissected these specimens, he should pay particular attention to their nostrils. There might well be a process that prevented the inrush of water. Nichols. The flow. The burst of confidence hinging upon what chance word? Something tolerably remote, since he couldn't remember it, had led to the abrupt statement, "I was ashore from the time Euryalus paid off until I was appointed to the Surprise, and I had a disagreement with my wife." Protestants often confess to medical men, and Stephen had heard this history before, always with the ritual plea for advice. The bitterly wounded wife, the wretched husband trying to atone, the civil imitation of a married life, the guarded words, politeness, restraint, resentment, the blank misery of nights and waking, the progressive decay of all friendship and communication. But he'd never heard it expressed with such piercing, desolate unhappiness. "I had thought it might be better when I was afloat," said Nichols. "But it was not. There'd no letter at Gibraltar, although Leopard was there before us, and Swiftsure. Every time I had the middle watch, I used to walk up and down, composing the answer I should send to the letters that would be waiting for me at Madeira. There were no letters. The packet had come and gone a fortnight before, while we were still in Gibraltar, and there were no letters. I really thought there must be a remaining, but however not so much as a note. I couldn't believe it, all the way down the trades. But now I do. And I tell you, Maturin, I can't bear it, not this long, slow death. There is certain to be a whole bundle of them at Rio," said Stephen. "I too received none at Madeira, virtually none. They are sure to be sent to Rio, rely upon it, or even to Bombay." "No," said Nichols with a toneless certainty. "There'll be no letters any more. I've bored you too long with my affairs. Forgive me. If I were to rig a shelter with the oars in my shirt, would you like to sit down under it? Surely this heat'll give you a sunstroke." "No, I thank you. Time is all too short. I must quickly explore the stationary ark. The dear knows when I shall see it again." Stephen hoped Nichols would not resent it later. Regular confession was far more formal, far less detailed and spreading, far less satisfactory in its unsacramental aspect. But at least a confessor was a priest his whole life through, whereas a doctor was an ordinary being much of the time. Difficult to face over the dinner table after such privities. He returned to his task. Thump, thump, thump. Pause. Thump, thump, thump. And as the crevice slowly widened, he noticed great drops falling on the rock, drying as they fell.
I shouldn't have thought I had any sweat left, he reflected, thumping on. Then he realized that drops were also falling on his back. Huge drops of warm rain, quite unlike the dung the countless birds had gratified him with. He stood up, looked round, and there, barring the western sky, was a darkness, and on the sea beneath it a white line approaching with inconceivable rapidity. No birds in the air, even on the crowded western side, and the middle distance was blurred by flying rain. The whole of the darkness was lit from within by red lightning, plain even in this glare. A moment later, the sun was swallowed up, and in the hot gloom, water hurtled down upon him. Not drops, but jets, as warm as the air and driving flatways with enormous force. And between the close-packed jets, a spray of shattered water, infinitely divided, so thick he could hardly draw in the air. He sheltered his mouth with his hands, breathed easier, let water gush through his fingers and drank it up, pint after pint. Although he was on the dome of the rock, the deluge covered his ankles, and there were his boxes, blowing, floating away. Staggering and crouching in the wind, he recovered two and squatted over them. And all the time the rain raced through the air, filling his ears with a roar that almost drowned the prodigious thunder. Now the squall was right overhead, the turning wind knocked him down, and what he had thought the ultimate degree of cataclysm increased tenfold. He wedged the boxes between his knees and crouched on all fours. Time took on another aspect. It was marked only by the successive lightning strokes that hissed through the air, darting from the cloud above, striking the rock and leaping back into the darkness. A few weak, stunned thoughts moved through his mind. What of the ship? Can any bird survive this? Is Nichols safe? It was over. The rain stopped instantly, and the wind swept the air clear. A few minutes later, the cloud had passed from the lowering sun, and it rode there, blazing from a perfect, even bluer sky. To westward, the world was unchanged, just as it always had been, apart from white caps on the sea. To the east, the squall still covered the place he had last seen the ship, and in the widening sunlit stretch between the rock and the darkness, a current bore a stream of fledgling birds, hundreds of them. And all along the stream he saw sharks, some large, some small, rising to the bodies. The whole rock was still streaming, the sound of running water everywhere. He splashed down the slope, calling, "Nichols! Nichols!" Some of the birds, he had to avoid them as he stepped, were still crouching flat over their egg or nestlings. Some were preening themselves. In three places there were jagged rows of dead terns and gannets, charred though damp, and smelling of the fire. He reached the spot where the shelter had been. No shelter. No fallen oars. And where they'd hauled up the boat, there was no boat. He made his way clean round the rock, leaning on the wind and calling in the emptiness. And when, for the second time, he came to the eastern side and looked out to sea, the squall had vanished. There was no ship to be seen. Climbing to the top, he caught sight of her, hull down and scudding before the wind under her foretopsail, her mizzen and main topmast gone. He watched until even the flicker of white disappeared. The sun had dipped below the horizon when he turned and walked down. The boobies had already set to their fishing again, and the higher birds were still in the sun, flashing pink as they dived through the fiery light. Chapter 6 It was the barge that took him off at last. The barge under Babington, with a powerful crew pulling double-banked right into the eye of the wind. "Are you all right, sir?" he shouted, as soon as they saw him sitting there. Stephen made no reply, but pointed for the boat to come round the other side. "Are you all right, sir?" cried Babington again, leaping ashore. "Where is Mr. Nichols?" Stephen nodded, and in a low croak he said, "I am perfectly well, I thank you. But poor Mr. Nichols, do you have any water in that boat? Light along the keg there. Bear a hand, bear a hand." Water. It flowed into him, irrigating his blackened mouth and cracking throat, filling his wizened body until his skin broke out into a sweat at last. And they stood over him, wondering, solicitous, respectful, shadowing him with a piece of sailcloth. They hadn't expected to find him alive. The disappearance of Nichols was in the natural course of events. "Is there enough for all?" he asked in a more human tone, pausing. "Plenty, sir, plenty. Another couple of breakers," said Bondon. "But, sir, do you think it right? You won't burst on us?" He drank, closing his eyes to savour the delight. A sharper pleasure than love, more immediate, intense. In time he opened them again and called out in a strong voice, "Stop that at once! You, sir, put that booby down! Stop it, I say, you murderous damned rapparees! For shame! And leave those stones alone! O'Connor! Bogoslowski! Brown! The rest of you! Get back into the boat!" cried Babington. "Now, sir, could you take a little something? Soup, a ham sandwich, a piece of cake?" "I believe not, thank you. If you will be so good as to have those birds, stones, eggs handed into the boat, and to carry the two small boxes yourself, perhaps we may shove off." "How is the ship? Where is it?"
4 or 5 leagues south by east, sir. Perhaps you saw our topgallants yesterday afternoon."
"Not I." "Is she damaged? People hurt?"
"Pretty well battered, sir. All aboard, Bondon?" "Easy, sir, easy now. Plum, bundle up that shirt for a pillow. Bondon, what are you at?"
"I'm coming at the umbrella, sir. I thought as maybe you wouldn't mind taking the tiller."
"Shove off," cried Babington. "Give way." The barge shot from the rock, swung round, hoisted jib and mainsail, and sped away to the southeast. "Well, sir," he said, settling to the tiller with the compass before him, "I'm afraid she was rather knocked about, and we lost some people. Old Tiddeman was swept out of the heads, and 3 of the boys went adrift before we could get them inboard. We were so busy looking at the sky in the west that we never had a hint of the white squall."
"White? Should it was black as an open grave."
"That was the second. The first was a white squall from due south a few minutes before yours. It often happens near the line, they say, but not so goddamn hard. Anyway, it hit us without a word of warning. The captain was below at the time in the sail room. Hit us topsails high, almost nothing on the surface, and laid us on our beam ends. Every sail blown clean out of its boat rope, before we could touch the sheets or halyards, not a scrap of canvas left."
"Even the pendant went," said Bondon.
"Yes, even the pendant went. Amazing. And main and mizzen topmast and fore-to-gallant all over to leeward, and there we were on our beam ends, all ports open and 3 guns breaking loose. Then there was the captain on deck with an axe in his hand, singing out and clearing all away, and she righted. But we hardly got our head round before the black squall hit us. Lord!"
"We got a scrap of canvas on at the foretopmast," said Bondon, "and scudded, there being these guns adrift on deck, and the captain wishful they shouldn't burst through the side. I was at the weather earing, said Plum, stern oar, and it took me half a glass to pass it, and it blew so hard it whipped my pigtail close to the boom iron, took a double turn in it, and Dick Turnbull had to cut me loose. That was a cruel hard moment, sir.
He turned his head to show the loss. 15 years of careful plaiting, combing, encouraging with best Macassar oil, reduced to a bristly stump 3 inches long.
But at least, said Babington, we did fill our water casks. Then we rigged a jury mizzen and main topmast, and we've been beating up ever since. An infinity of details. Babington's low, anxious inquiries after Nichols, the surprisingly ready philosophical acceptance of his death, more details of yards sprung, bowsprits struck by lightning, great exertions day and night. And Stephen slept, the piece of cake in his hand.
"There she lays,"
said Bondon's voice through his dispersing dream.
"They've sent up a fortergallant. Captain will be main glad to see you, sir. Said you could never last on that fucking rock. On deck all day and night. Hands about ship every glass. God love us," he said with a chuckle, remembering the ferocious compulsion, the pitiless driving of men 3 parts dead with fatigue. He was quite upset.
He had indeed been quite upset. But the news from the masthead that the returning barge carried an animate surgeon reassured the greater part of his mind. He was still in strong anxiety for Nichols, however, and the 2 emotions showed on his face as he leant over the rail. Gravity, and yet a flush of pleasure and a smile that would be spreading. Stephen came nimbly up the side, almost like a seaman.
"No, no, I'm perfectly well," he said, "but I'm deeply concerned to tell you that Mr. Nichols and the boat vanished entirely. I searched the rocks that evening, the next day and the next. No trace at all."
"I'm most heartily sorry for it," said Jack, shaking his head and looking down. He was a very good officer. After a moment he said, "Come, you must go below and to bed. M'Allister shall physic you. Mr. M'Allister, pray take Dr. Maturin below."
"Let me carry you, sir," said Pullings. "I'll give you a hand," said Harvey.
The whole quarter-deck and the greater part of the ship's company were gazing at the resuscitated doctor, his older shipmates with plain delight, the others with heavy wonder. Pullings went so far as to push between the captain and the surgeon and to seize him by the arm.
"I have not the least wish to go below," said Stephen sharply, twitching himself away. "A pot of coffee is all that I require."
He moved a little way aft, caught sight of Mr. Stanhope, and cried, "Your Excellency, I must beg your pardon for not having kept my engagement with you on Sunday.
Allow me to congratulate you upon your preservation," said Mr. Stanhope, advancing and shaking hands.
He spoke with more than his ordinary formality, for Stephen was mother naked. And although Mr. Stanhope had seen naked men before, he had never seen one with eyes so reddened by the salt and the intolerable sun that they shone like cherries, nor one so wizened, so wrinkled in his loose blackened skin, so encrusted and cadaverous.
"I wish you joy of your rescue, Doctor," said Mr. Atkins, the only man aboard who was not pleased to see the barge return.
Stephen was attached to the mission in an artfully vague capacity, and the envoy's instructions required him to seek Dr. Maturin's advice. Mr. Atkins' advice, or indeed presence, was nowhere mentioned, and he was consumed with jealousy.
"May I fetch you a towel or some other garment?"
with a look at Stephen's scrofulous, shrunken belly.
"You are very officious, sir. But this is the garment in which I shall appear before God.
I find it answers pretty well. It may be termed my birthday suit.
That's choked the bugger off, said Pullings to Babington, just above his breath, out of a motionless face. That's one in his bleeding eye.
In the morning he appeared, eager and sharp set at the breakfast table, on the first stroke of the bell.
"Are you sure you shouldn't stay abed?"
cried Jack.
"Never in life so," said Stephen, reaching for the coffee-pot. "Am I not telling you forever that I'm well? A slice of that ham, if you please. No, in all sobriety, if it had not been for poor unhappy Nichols, I should have been glad to be marooned. It was uncomfortable. I was roasted, to be sure, but it has done extraordinary things to my sinews, more than the waters of Bath in 100 years. No pain, no awkwardness. I could dance a jig, and an elegant jig, and quite apart from that, what else would have allowed me day after day of detailed observation? The arthropods alone. Before I went to bed last night, before I turned in, I threw down a mass of undigested notes, and merely for the arthropods, there were 17 pages. You shall see them. You shall have the maidenhead of my observations.
I shall be very happy, thank you, Stephen.
Then I sponged myself repeatedly from head to foot with fresh water, your blessed fresh water, and I slept. It was like falling slowly into a bottomless void, so deep that this morning I had difficulty in recalling the events of yesterday. A vague recollection of the sick bay that I had to piece together from fragments that came swimming up. I fear I shall have a sad report for you when I've made my rounds this morning.
"Certainly you look less like a burnt offering than you did yesterday," said Jack, peering affectionately into his face. "Your eyes are almost human."
"But," he said, feeling that this was not perfectly civil, "they will behold a charming sight on deck. We've picked up the southeast trade at last. It's coming more southerly than I could wish, but I believe we shall weather Cape St. Roch. At all events, we shall cross the line before noon. We've been making 7 and 8 knots since the beginning of the middle watch. Another cup. Tell me, Stephen, what did you drink on that infernal rock?"
"Boiled shit."
Stephen was chaste in his speech, rarely an oath, never an obscene word, never any bawdy. His reply astonished Jack, who looked quickly at the tablecloth. Perhaps it was a learned term he'd misunderstood. "Boiled shit," he said again. Jack smiled in a worldly fashion, but he felt the blush rising. "Yes. There was one single pool of rainwater left in a hollow. The birds defecated in it copiously, not with set intent. The whole rock is normally deep in their droppings, but enough to foul it to the pitch of nausea. The next day was hotter, if possible, and with the reverberation the liquid rose to an extraordinary temperature. I drank it, however, until it ceased to be a liquid at all. Then I turned to blood. Poor, unsuspecting booby's blood, tempered with a little sea-water and the expressed juice of kelp. Blood. Jack, this Cape St. Roch of which you speak so anxiously is in Brazil. Is it not the home of the vampire?"
"I beg your pardon, sir, for interrupting you," said Harvey, appearing at the door. "But you desired me to let you know when the main-to-gallant was ready to be swayed up."
Left alone, Stephen looked at his nailless hand, flexed it with great complacency. Remarkable intention. Precise. Unwavering. Carried out a delicate operation on the ham with his pocket lancet. And walked forward to the sick bay, observing, "I couldn't have done that before. I was broiled alive, desiccated, mummified.
Bless the sun in his power. They crossed the line that day, but with muted ceremonies. It was not only the loss of their shipmates and of Mr. Nichols, the loss emphasized by the sale of their clothes at the capstan head, but there was not much spirit of fun in the ship. Badgerbag came aboard with his trident, shaved the boys and the younger hands in a perfunctory manner, mulcted Stephen, Mr. Stanhope, and his people of 6 and 8 pence a head, splashed a fair amount of water about the forecastle and the waist of the ship, and withdrew. "That was our Saturnalia," said Jack. "I hope you didn't dislike it."
"Not at all. I am wholly in favour of innocent mirth. But I wonder you suffered it with so much work on hand, all these spars, ropes, and sails lying about half destroyed, and time, as you tell me, so precious.
Oh, you mustn't interfere with custom. They'll work double tides tomorrow. They'll be in much better heart. Custom. You are hag-ridden by custom in the Navy," said Stephen.
"Bells. An esoteric language. I'll not say jargon. Unmeaning ceremonies.
The selling of poor Nichols' clothes, for example, seemed to me gross impiety, and to Mr. Stanhope, too. He's a far more interesting man than you might suppose. Reads, plays a delicate flute. But I'm not come here to be prating of the envoy. I have something far graver to tell you. The incessant labours of the last week have exhausted the men. Many who showed no signs of scurvy at the last examination are now affected. Here is my list. Virtually all the raccoons, many surprises, and 4 landsmen. What is worse, the squall in wrecking my storeroom has made the strangest magma of my drugs, to say nothing of the remaining and more than doubtful lime juice. I tell you officially, my dear, and will put it in writing if you choose, that I cannot be answerable for the consequences unless green vegetables, fresh meat, and above all citrus fruits are provided within a few days. If I understand you, you mean to skirt the extremity of eastern Brazil. And eastern Brazil, he cried, looking greedily through the open port westwards, is notoriously supplied with all these commodities.
So it is, said Jack,
and with vampires.
Oh, do not imagine I've not examined my conscience, cried Stephen, laying his hand on Jack's bosom. Do not suppose I'm unaware of my eagerness to set foot upon the new world at the earliest possible moment. But come and look at my suppurating 5-year-old amputation, my reopening once healthy wounds, my purulent gums, impostumes, low fevers, livid extravasations.
I was hardly serious, said Jack, but the fact is there are many things I have to take into account.
There were indeed. This was a very long voyage, and already he'd lost a great deal of time. With the Cape in the hands of the Dutch again, he must get right down to the 40s, to the great unfailing westerlies that would carry him into the Indian Ocean at 200 miles a day, to catch the tail of the southwest monsoon somewhere about the height of Madagascar. His orders required him to touch at Rio, which was not much above 1,000 miles away, no great distance if the hard-won trades held true, whereas if he stood in with the land he might lose them. He would certainly be entangled with the Portuguese officials if he called at Recife, for example. Interminable delay at the best, and at the worst some ugly incident, detention, even violence, they being so very jealous of a foreign man-of-war anywhere but Rio. Delay, perhaps a row, and even then no certainty of supplies. And although Stephen was speaking in good faith, the dear creature was so
passionate a philosopher with his bugs, vampires.
"Let me consider of it, Stephen," he said. "I'll come to the sick bay."
"Very well.
And as we go, pray consider of this too. My rats have vanished. The squall did not take them. Their cage was undamaged, but its door was open. I turned my back for 5 minutes to take the air on St. Paul's Rock, and my valuable rats disappear. If this is one of your naval customs, I can wish you all crucified at your own royal yards, and flayed alive before you are nailed up. This is not the first time I've suffered so. An asp of Fuenarola, 3 mice in the Gulf of Lyon, rats I had brought up by hand, cosseted since berry head, crammed with best double-refined matter in spite of their growing reluctance, and now all is lost, the entire experiment rendered nugatory, utterly destroyed.
But why did you feed them with matter?
Because Duhamel tells us that the red is fixed and concentrated in their bones. I wished to find the rate of penetration and to know whether it reached the marrow. I shall know in time, however. Alistair and I will dissect all suitable subjects, for the effect will be passed to those that ate them, of course. And I tell you soberly, Jack, that if you persist in this dogged, self-defeating hurry, 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 clap on more sails, not a moment to be lost, then most of the people will pass through our hands, including, no doubt, that black thief whose very bones will blush for shame. He uttered these words in a high shriek at the entrance to the sick bay, to make himself heard above the armourer's forge, where they were fashioning a new iron horse to replace that carried away in the squall. Jack looked at the crowded berth. He breathed the fetid air that no wind-sail would carry away. He stood by while Stephen and Alistair undid bandages and showed him the effects of scurvy upon old wounds. He didn't give an inch, even when they led him to their chief witness, the 5-year-old amputated stump. But when they showed him a box of teeth and sent for their walking cases to see how easily even molars came out, and to make him palpate their rotting gums, he said he was satisfied and hurried aft. "Killick," he said, "I shall not be having any dinner today. Pass the word for Mr. Babington." Here, at least, was something pleasant to take the charnel house smell away. "Ah, Mr. Babington, there you are. Sit down. I dare say you know why I have sent for you."
"No, sir,"
said Babington instantly. It was worth denying everything as long as he could. "How is your servitude coming along? You must be close on your time."
5 years, 9 months, and 3 days, sir."
After 6 years on ship's books, a midshipman might pass for lieutenant, might change from a reefer, a non-entity discharged or disrated at pleasure, to a godlike commissioned officer. And Babington knew the date to the very hour.
"Yes.
Well, I'm going to give you an order as acting lieutenant in poor Nichols' place. By the time we reach the Admiral, you will have your time and you can sit your board. And I dare say the Admiralty will confirm the appointment. They'll never fail you on seamanship, I'm very sure. But it might be wise to beg Mr. Harvey to give you a hand with your double altitudes."
"Oh, thank you. Thank you, sir,"
cried Babington, suffused with joy. It was not wholly unexpected. He had bought one of Nichols' coats on the off chance. But it had been far from certain. Braithwaite, the other senior midshipman, who had bought 2 coats, 2 waistcoats, 2 pair of breeches, had as good a claim to the step. And some sharp words had passed between Babington and his captain at Madeira,
This ship is not a floating brothel, sir. Sharper still about relieving the watch in time. It was an exquisite moment. And the kind words with which Jack finished, shaping well, responsible, officer-like, should feel as easy with Babington keeping a watch as any officer on the ship, brought tears to Babington's eyes. Yet in the midst of his joy, his heart smote him, and pausing at the door after the usual acknowledgements, he turned and said in a faltering voice,
"You're so very kind to me, sir, always have been, that it seems a blackguardly thing. You might not have done it if... But I didn't exactly lie, however."
"Eh?" cried Jack, astonished. In time it appeared that Babington had eaten of the doctor's rats, and that he was sorry now.
"Why, no, Babington," said Jack. "No. That was an infernal shabby thing to do. Mean and very like a scrub. The doctor's been a good friend to you. None better. Who patched up your arm when they all swore it must come off? Who put you into his cot and sat by you all night holding the wound? Who..."
Babington couldn't bear it. He burst into tears. Though an acting lieutenant, he wiped his eyes on his sleeve, and through his sobs he gave Jack to understand that unknown hands had wafted these prime millers into the larboard midshipman's berth, that although he had had no hand in their cutting out, indeed would have prevented it, having the greatest love for the doctor, so much so that he had fought Braithwaite over a chest for calling the doctor a Dutch-built quiz, yet the rats, being already dead and dressed with onion sauce, and he, so hungry after rattling down the shrouds, he had thought it a pity to let the others scoff the lot, had lived with a troubled conscience ever since, had in fact expected a summons to the cabin.
"You would have been living with a troubled stomach if you'd known what was in 'em." The doctor had...
"I tell you what it is, Jack," said Stephen, walking quickly in. "Oh, I beg your pardon."
"No, stay, Doctor, stay, if you please," cried Jack.
Babington looked wretchedly from one to the other, licked his lips, and said, "I ate your rat, sir. I'm very sorry, and I ask your pardon."
"Did you so?" said Stephen mildly. "Well, I hope you enjoyed it.
Listen, Jack, will you look at my list now?"
"He only ate it when it was dead," said Jack.
"It would have been a strangely hasty, agitated meal had he ate it before," said Stephen, looking attentively at his list.
"Tell me, sir, did you happen to keep any of the bones?"
"No, sir. I'm very sorry, but we usually crunch them up like larks. Some of the chaps said they looked uncommon dark, however."
"Poor fellows.
Poor fellows," said Stephen in a low, inward voice.
"Do you wish me to take notice of this theft, Dr. Maturin?" asked Jack.
"No, my dear, none at all. Nature will take care of that, I'm afraid."
He wandered back to the sick bay, and there, when he had carried out some dressings, he asked M'Alister how many lived in the larboard midshipman's berth. On being told 6, he wrote out a prescription and desired M'Alister to make it up into 6 boluses. On deck, Stephen was conscious of being closely, furtively watched. And after dinner, at a time when he was judged to be in a benevolent frame of mind, he was not surprised to receive a deputation from the young gentlemen, all washed and wearing coats, in spite of the heat. They, too, were very sorry they had eaten his rats. They, too, begged his pardon, and they should never do so again.
"Young gentleman," he said, "I have been expecting you. Mr. Callow, be so good as to take this note with my best compliments to the captain." He wrote, "Can the services of the young gentleman and the clerk be dispensed with for a day?" folded it and handed it over. In the interval he gazed at Meadows and Scott, first-class volunteers aged 12 and 14, the captain's clerk, a hairy 16, with his wrists far beyond the sleeves of his last year's jacket, Joliffe and Church, 15-year-old midshipmen, all thinner, hungrier than their mothers could have wished. And they gazed covertly back at him, their habitual thoughtless merriment quenched, turned to a pasty solemnity. "The captain's compliments, sir," said Callow, "and he says with the greatest possible ease. A week, if you choose."
"Thank you, Mr. Callow. You will oblige me by swallowing this bolus. Mr. Joliffe, Mr. Church." The surprise lay hove to, the precious trade winds singing through her rigging, fleeting away unused. Broad on her starboard beam, Cape St. Roque advanced into the sea. A bold headland, so thickly covered with tropical forest that not a patch of bare earth, not a rock, could be seen, except at the edge of the sea, where the surf broke upon a shining beach, indented here and there with creeks that ran into the trees. One of these inlets had a stream. Its turbid waters could be seen mingling with the blue, spreading on either side of the little bar, and by following its course one could make out the roofs of a village some way inland. Just these roofs, nothing more. The whole of the rest of the New World was ancient, luxuriating forest, a solid mass of different shades of green, not a wisp of smoke, not a hut, not a track. Jack's telescope, poised on the hammock cloth, brought the forest so close that he could see half-fallen trunks, held in a tangle of gigantic creepers, new trees pushing through, even the flashing scarlet of a bird, the very colour of a blaze of flowers a little to the right. But most of the time he kept it fixed upon the roofs, the stream, hoping hour after hour to surprise a movement there. His idea had seemed brilliant in the morning light, with Brazil looming in the west. They would not go to Recife, nor any other port, but coast along and send the launch ashore at the nearest fishing village. No trouble with any authorities, almost no loss of time. Stephen was convinced that any cultivated stretch of this shore would provide what he needed. "All we require is green stuff," he said, looking at Cape St. Roque. "And what outside the Vale of Limerick could be greener than that?" Then they saw these canoes running up the creek and the roofs beyond. As Stephen was the only officer aboard who spoke Portuguese and who could be sure of the sick bay's needs, it was sensible that he should go. But he had had to be persuaded. And on leaving, with a partially concealed, wild, secret grin on his face, he had sworn upon his honour that he was uninfluenced by vampires, that he should not bring a single vampire aboard. Behind Jack, the work of the ship was going on. They were taking advantage of this pause to new-reeve most of the rigging on the mainmast, and to re-stow the booms. But it was going forward slowly, with the boatswain and his mates driving the sparse, dispirited crew with more noise and less effect than usual. The sound of distant wrangling came from the carpenters in the forward cockpit. And Mr. Harvey was in an unusual passion, too. "Where have you been, Mr. Callow?" he cried. "It's 10 minutes since I told you to bring me the azimuth compass."
"Only at the head, sir,"
said Callow, glancing nervously at the captain's back.
"The head? The head? Every single midshipman gives me that lame old excuse today. Jolliffe is at the head, Meadows is at the head, Church is at the head. What's the